Hello and welcome to the Community and University MSU Center for Community and Economic Development podcast, aimed at providing outreach to both community members and students throughout the state of Michigan. I'm Jeannie Anjandi, Regional Economic Innovation Coordinator, one of the hosts for Community and University. And today I'm joined by 2021 REI Innovation Fellow, Chris Miller. Innovation Fellows provide on-the-ground support and coordination to turn concepts into actions and implement new economic development tools, models, policies, and practices. Chris is also the chair of the National Coalition for Community Capital. Listeners should also know that I am also a board member of NC3. Good afternoon, Chris, and welcome. I'm excited to have you as a guest.
Good afternoon. That is a powerful agenda that it you is. Guys have here at MSU REI.
It is a mouthful.
It is, yeah. But it's all great stuff. So
awesome. So let's start out with you telling me a little bit about yourself and your 2021 Innovation Fellowship.
So I began really focusing on economic development as a member of my small city, Adrian, in southern Michigan in 2009. I had moved into Adrian. My wife and I had moved in with our four kids in 1999. And we immediately got involved in the community and discovered that it was not quite the vibrant downtown, especially in community, that we thought it was. There are two four-year post-secondary institutions, Adrian College and St. Ives University, within the city limits, as well as Jackson College, a community college out of Jackson, that also had a campus there. So we thought it was going to be this kind of vibrant, smaller college town, 22,000 people, about 100,000 in the county. And that didn't turn out to be the case. And so I got involved in the downtown initially, ended up being appointed to the Downtown Development Authority Board, and realized that if I wanted to do more and have a bigger impact, that I needed to do something different. So I was appointed to the City Commission and then elected to the City Commission, and again came to the epiphany that I would have more luck doing economic development on the ground in the city than I would directing the city administrator as part of the City Commission. And so in 2009, I resigned from the City Commission and went to work as the city's economic developer. That was, you may remember, 2009, the Great Recession. Not that great. So I had no economic development training, no business training, no finance training. All I was passionate about community and figured out, I'll figure this out. And so the number one challenge right there for any, at that point in time, at anybody who was doing economic development was access to capital, because it wasn't available. I had businesses in my community that had a 20-year relationship with the bank and they couldn't get $100,000 to add a new product. So I started reading about communities that had found atypical ways to put capital together and stumbled across two authors, Michael Schumann, who is the most prolific of the writers on community capital and local investing and recirculation of capital, et cetera. And Amy Cortez, who was writing at that point in time a lot for the New York Times, and she had written her own book called Locavesting. And Amy's book was a series of gentle case studies about communities across the country that had found an interesting way to put capital together and get something important done in the community. I got a few of the people in the community reading these books, and we decided that what we really should do was invite Amy to town, because, you know, people from New York come to Adrian, Michigan all the time, and speak at a quarterly economic development luncheon that we had. So we went to our local Chamber of Commerce executive director, who was a really forward-thinking woman named Ann Hughes, and we said, Ann, would you invite Amy Cortez to come to town and speak at the economic development? And so Ann did, and Amy came, surprisingly. And she's a New York City person, and so she didn't drive. So we had to pick her up at the airport and drive her everywhere, and I got to do a lot of that. And she then presented. We had 50 or 60 people in the room, so it was a big deal. And she's about 5 foot tall, and she stood in front of this room behind the mic, which almost dwarfed her, and she told her stories. And she wasn't a public speaker. She was a great writer, but she wasn't a great public speaker. But the room was dead silent the whole time. And she got a rousing round of applause at the end of it. And it was inspirational because of the story she was telling. And there's actually a Michigan story in her book, and it's Cops and Donuts in Clara, Michigan. And in that story, there was a third generation bakery that had been there since the early 1900s, and it was going to close. And there was nobody to take the business over, no more family, no staff. wanted to take it over. So the 9 members of the police department pooled their resources, bought it, and renamed it in a moment of genius, Cops and Donuts. And it's now the second largest employer, I think, in downtown Clare, and they've actually franchised it out. So those were inspirational stories. And the 2 things that happened really directly from Amy's presentation was we had a group of folks who had been talking for a couple of years about buying a building and fixing it up. We had quite a few really beautiful historic buildings in downtown that were just having a hard time and were empty or being foreclosed. So they ended up pulling together about 24 local investors, none of them big professional investors, mostly just regular folks that had done okay.
So can I ask you?
Yeah, if you don't stop me, I'll just keep talking. So.
No, but it's very interesting because I feel like at that moment, you know, when they heard these inspirational stories, this was in the time of, you know, the recession and, you know, many businesses were, you know, struggling, if not, you know, shutting down.
Yep.
Did you sense the room at that moment that there was buy-in around community capital and support, or were there certain individuals were still hesitant about it? What was the environment like?
Yeah, it was certainly a mix. You know, we had some very traditional folks, including all the traditional bankers and everything that were in the room. Now, and so the Jobs Act had passed. Amy referenced the Jobs Act. And so we knew that there was legislation that had passed, but this was 2013. So
can you tell us what the Jobs Act is?
Yeah, that's great. Doesn't everybody know?
Yeah.
Right. So the Jobs Act was legislation that passed in D.C. in 2012, in spring of 2012, and signed by the president, by President Obama. And actually, Amy Cortese and Michael Schumann, the 2 authors I met, were both in the Rose Garden for that because they were a part of that kind of ecosystem around. Michael probably deserves a significant amount of credit for the idea itself, although he was not one of the attorneys that made it happen. But in any event, so the Jobs Act empowered the about 90% of the population that are what's called non-accredited investors. And this is a vestige of the stock market crash and the Great Depression, when the federal government created the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC. And the role of the SEC, as bizarre as it sounds, is to protect us American investors from making bad investment decisions.
So the SEC practically is protecting, quote unquote, protecting 90% of the population.
That's exactly
right. So doesn't
that
remove the 90% from being able to invest and to grow wealth?
That's exactly what it does. And but it was, you know, you heard when you learned about the Great Depression, you heard horror stories about women, poor widows that lost all their life savings and all that sort of thing. So it was a logical response in some sense. What evolved starting in 1933 and in 1940 and then even some legislation that happened later and some rulemaking that happened later was this division into accredited investors, which wound up being most of the time about 10% of the population, and non-accredited investors. And that line of demarcation was purely an issue of wealth. They concluded if you had enough money, you must be smart enough to invest in it. If you didn't have enough money, you weren't smart enough to make a direct investment.
So what would that be? What is enough money to be an accredited investor?
Yeah, so today it's $1 million worth of net worth, not including your home, or a couple $100,000 in income. I think it's 150 on an individual and 300,000 for a couple, something along those lines. Don't quote me on that because that
so
I probably got.
So if I'm an accredited investor, where would I be able to invest? Anywhere?
Any amount, whatever you want to do.
And so let's say I'm 90%, you know, in the 90% of the non-accredited.
Yeah.
So how does this limit me in my investment?
It would limit you by prohibiting you from doing any of that. And it would require you to use an intermediary to make an investment decision for you. So you would have to go to an investment advisor or a banker or a CPA and have them make investment decisions for you.
And so I wouldn't be able to make that on my own. I would have the advisor would make it on my behalf on how they see fit.
That's correct. Yeah. So it really disenfranchised many of us, most of us, for a long time, you know, for over 70 years. That's been the case. So the Jobs Act did that. So it promised. And there was lots of recognition at that point in time in 2013, after the bill had passed, that communities needed to find a way for capital. So at the same time that's happening, of course, part of what also happened in the Great Recession was bank consolidation because there were new rules. And so we had this you know, kind of perfect storm. And then when you add in the growth of online shopping, which had really start to take off during that same period of time. You have this trifecta of happenings that come together and say it's really going to be tough for communities to make decisions about what's built in their communities because they don't have very much control of the capital that's in their communities anymore. So between not having a local banker who can make a decision, this is a good guy, we're going to give him a business loan, to some guy often in another state who's looking at a spreadsheet and making that decision. And what's that spreadsheet better say? That we're getting more out of that community than we're putting into that community.
And then I'd actually like to add to that, one of the issues when you're thinking about investors that are not part of a community, what happens is when that business shuts down, those buildings are boarded up or what have you, that the responsibility now becomes on the local taxpayer.
Right.
And this is a burden on the community that creates further disinvestment or can create further disinvestment.
Right.
So, well, I want to have you like finish a little bit about that, but I also want like the idea of what does community capital look like? You know, is it, you know, a group of people bringing money together? How does it actually work?
So at NC3, we've spent a lot of time thinking about community capital and talking about what it means. And so for us, it means when a significant portion of the regular people in a community, you know, a broad cross-section of the community, makes a meaningful investment in a project that happens in their community. And again, the Jobs Act empowered all of those folks to make a decision. And then the rise of investment crowdfunding, which was really created by the Jobs Act and similar legislation in a lot of states, including Michigan, where state-based exemptions happened. We now have had an experience. The Jobs Act wasn't empowered by the SEC until 2016. So it actually took 4 years from when the legislation was written until it was actually enacted. But since then, since from 2016 until 2024, there's been well over $1 billion of money invested, most often a little less than about 2 million non-accredited investors have been investing in small businesses and tech and green businesses and a lot of other things. And starting recently, real estate, we've seen a lot of investment. Regular folks have been making investments in that. I've been involved in a number of investment crowdfunding campaigns here in Michigan, in my own community, and elsewhere. And I've watched time after time how that happens, how it brings people. So when you get this project done, you're excited about it because you believe in it. And it's a good thing because this is not going to be some big corporation from somewhere else coming in and occupying some space in your community. It is a local business, somebody that you might know or friends of yours are related to or go to school with your kids or whatever. So you feel good about that project getting done. But now you have this added layer. We're also bound together financially. And, you know, finances are intimate to our lives, right? And critical to our lives and to our communities. It is the lifeblood of our communities. So now we have an opportunity to invest local and to make this thing happen that we're very proud of and that we do have our birthday parties and business meetings and book clubs at because we believe in it. But it also does some other really interesting things. So one of the real challenges in wealth building today is we do not have wealth builds when capital recirculates. So people don't necessarily think about that happening. But so I live in community X and I get a job and I pay taxes in X. And then when my paycheck comes in, I go to a town and I spend some money at a restaurant and I go to a local supermarket and I go to a local hardware store and a local clothing store and a local food store. All of those proprietors, when they get my money, they invest it in a bank and they spend part of it also in the community, one of their suppliers and that sort of thing. It is that recirculation of capital that builds wealth. And in communities where we don't have recirculation of capital, it is virtually impossible to build wealth. One of my favorite examples of this, in a sad way, is in the city of Detroit, where NC3 is doing a big project we're very excited about in Southwest Detroit. But in Detroit, when a dollar comes into the city of Detroit via somebody's paycheck, it exits Detroit in less than 20 minutes. So there is no way to build wealth with that dollar because it's no longer in the community. And it's no longer in the community because there aren't community-based businesses. There aren't enough of them to get that dollar and reinvest it 2 or 3 or 5 or 6 or 7, 10 times.
So correct me if I'm wrong. So what you're basically, what I'm hearing you say, that communities connected to the individual, individuals connected to the community. We need each other. And if we don't build and stabilize like our local economies, then the individual and those families living in those communities also pay a price from that. But when we actually circulate and recirculate that wealth within community, then I also benefit from that.
Exactly. Right. It is really the only way to build resilience in local economies is to find ways to circulate that capital. And everything that we've done, everything that our free market system has done, has worked against that, because it is rewarded behavior which sort of codifies the kinds of businesses, creates the easiest thing is to create the same thing over and over again in a bunch of different communities, and to sort of impose the will of these big corporations on those communities. And they are simply places to harvest capital for them. Are the numbers there? Then good, let's put a store there. And we're going to take as much out of that as we possibly can. It's good business. And it is good business when you look at it from that lens.
I always say good business for who?
Exactly.
It's good business for those who are getting a return on investment,
right?
And they're the top, percentages, in the U.S.
Right.
And you think about ways that community capital, benefits local community, but is it anecdotal? So this sounds like a great idea. How do we know it works? Why should we start this?
So it's a great question. And that's really been one of the challenges. When we started talking about this in 2012 and 2013, it was purely anecdotal. We had no real ideas. We all had this sort of gut feeling, if it looks like a duck and talks like a duck, and it's a duck, But so the completely transparent answer is that we are only sort of certain about some pieces of this. We have seen some really promising data. We've seen lots of really promising anecdotal stories where we can point to those kinds of things, and we can point to individual projects that happen in individual communities. We can demonstrate how much more they're paying in taxes and the people that are employed and where they live. And those things all look very good. We're just starting to see in aggregate a lot of data on the investment crowdfunding world. And it's good stuff. One of my favorite places to point is a platform called Honeycomb Credit. And Honeycomb has made a real effort across the country. They work in about 30 different states, maybe more. They'll get mad at me if I got that wrong. 30 or more, guys. But they have really made an effort to work in more challenged communities with women founders, with founders of color. And they have been overwhelmingly successful getting those businesses started in those communities. And so we can see some really direct things. So, for example, the venture capital world, and when you hear about financing business, VCs are always talked about, angel investors, venture capitalists. Again, that's the top 10% that's doing that. Last year, they gave less than 3% of their money to women-founded businesses. It's hard to imagine how that could even happen.
That's actually unbelievable.
It is an unbelievable statistic. Versus Honeycomb Credit, that is now giving about 40% of its money to women founders and a similar percent to founders of color.
So does community capital speak more to equitable economic development?
It speaks directly to equitable economic development, because it is. It provides a measure of equity and opportunity that traditional capital hasn't done for a long time.
Yeah.
And I want to say one other thing, because it was key to some work we've done here in Michigan. So in Canada, they have a much easier job of putting pooled investment vehicles together. It's very difficult in the U.S. to put in this. And part of what NC3 is on is working on the policy side to get some new legislation federally, and also some state-based legislation in some circumstances. We can move the needle on this. But in Michigan, we introduced some investment crowdfunding legislation that, when we get it done, will be first in the nation, we think. And essentially, it's going to provide a state of Michigan income tax credit to any Michigan citizen who invests in a Michigan business, as the IRS would define that business.
So you're referring to House Bill 4691.
House Bill 4691. Yeah, exactly. That's impressive that you knew that.
Yeah.
So maybe you've helped with that. So anyway, House Bill 4691 provides a state of Michigan income tax credit equal to 50% of the amount of the investment. So I'm going to be limited in terms of how much I can invest in the bill.
Why would you want to limit?
So first of all, we needed to put a limit in it. So both federal legislation and state legislation all limits the amount of money a non-accredited investor can invest. In this bill, we were able to persuade the Michigan Department of Treasury to not oppose legislation which involves a tax credit, which they do as a matter of course. Understandably, a tax credit is an unknown on a future spreadsheet. And so you don't want an unknown liability in a future fraud suit if you're a CPA, like Governor Schneider was. Part of the reason he eliminated those because he didn't like them, or if you are responsible for the Treasury Department. But fortunately, in Canada, they've got a much easier job putting pooled investment vehicles together. And so in Nova Scotia in 1999, they set up a pooled investment vehicle that everyone in Nova Scotia, all the regular folks, could invest in, and then would turn right around. That pool would then be turn around and invest in local businesses to get them expanded or starting or whatever the case may be. And in 2019, someone did some scholarly research on that for the first time. And I got a hold of that white paper in 2020 or 2021, about the time I was doing the fellowship here. And so that demonstrated the efficacy of this kind of investment. And I'll just give you some high numbers that are mostly accurate, might have missed a little bit. So in 2019, regular Nova Scotians invested $2 million in that pooled investment vehicle. That costs the province $700,000 in tax credits. They took that $2 million and they invested in about 115 small businesses or startups. And those businesses created 1,200 full-time employees, FTEs.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, and they were paid about $58 million in wages and taxes and salaries, which generated for the province an additional $25 million in new taxes for $700,000. So that's a cost per job of less than $600 per job they created jobs. So if you talk to my friends at the MEDC about how many jobs they're creating for $600 a job, and they will just laugh because they spend a lot more to do it. Now they're doing different things with it, but nonetheless, it's really, really effective. And so that was how we persuaded the Treasury Department to say, let's give this a go, because this might actually result in more income for the Treasury Department, not less income, because of the tax credits.
So I'm even thinking now we've got a greater benefit to community capital, investing locally.
Yes.
It's generating, you know, more revenue that is taxable.
Yep.
And then that actually benefits not just your local community, but impacts your state.
Absolutely.
Sure. So, you know, this kind of investment has many, many levels. So I'm kind of curious, and it's all about your comfort level, Chris. You know, do you have any personal experience in working in community capital, not on the, you know, development side, but, you know, have you pooled resources within your community to create a business? And
yes.
Can you speak to that?
I can. So first of all, when Michigan, so we passed our own investment crowdfunding law in 2013. And at that time, I was made aware of some entrepreneurs in Tecumseh, the neighboring community to us, second largest city in Lanaway County, that wanted to create a micro brewery. You know, it was a big thing. It's still a big thing in Michigan, but it was really a big thing in then. And this team came from a guy who came from California to go to the law, to the business school at the University of Michigan, that other school. And his partner, who was the son of entrepreneurs from Tecumseh, Michigan. And they ended up working at an establishment in Ann Arbor where the guy from California ran the business and the other guy brewed the beer. And they decided to form a partnership and build a business in Tecumseh. They did a friends and family raise and raised enough money to buy a building. So they owned a building free and clear. This is 2013. And they couldn't get a loan to add on to that and to buy the equipment, to build out the kitchen, to build out the brewery, all that stuff. And I got introduced to them right about the time where Amy had put this idea in my head to do this investment crowdfunding exemption for the state. And I really naively told these guys, we're going to get an investment crowdfunding law done in Michigan, and you could be the first company in the state to do that. And that actually is exactly what happened. So we introduced it in fall of 2013. I was in Governor Snyder's office when he signed the bill at the end of 2013. And they were the first business in Michigan, and they raised $175,000 from a couple dozen people in the community to create their business. And then more recently, during COVID, my wife and her business partners decided that they wanted to open up a cafe in downtown Adrian.
Sounds like a good time to open up a cafe.
Yeah, well, not so much. But so they started working on it before COVID, and we secured a building. And because I'm me, they had to do an investment crowdfunding raise for it. But we raised $120,000 from 45 investors from 7 different states. Wow. Who all invested in the Buzz Cafe and Marketplace in downtown Adrian.
Wow.
And they opened up during COVID, when you couldn't have anybody in your restaurant. So for the first 6 months, it was partial capacity, no capacity, and partial capacity until they got done. They just had their third anniversary. And it is the kind of people where those investors come in and have book clubs and business meetings and birthday parties and breakfast every Friday or every Saturday kind of thing.
So if this bill actually passes and it goes into law, what does it look like for me as an investor in my local community? What does it look like for a business in my local community?
So it means that the business can go, you know, we're going to, and we expect, because this is such a significant incentive, a 50% incentive, on top of the return on investment that you hope to get from that investment. And so we expect businesses to be all over this, and we're working with the MEDC and the Michigan Municipal League and a bunch of other organizations, including Michigan State University, to get the word out on this. But it's very broadly supported in the business community, so they recognize the value. But they will be able to then to go on a platform and put their offering up. And virtually 95% of the times when a business wants to do it, they use a platform to do it because they can manage all of that.
So does it look like a crowdfunding platform?
Looks like a crowdfunding platform, right, exactly. And as a Michigan citizen, I can invest my money in it, and I can invest up to $3,000 in that. And that's what is eligible for that 50% tax credit. And then come tax time, then that actually gets submitted to the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, and they will approve that. Essentially, what they're saying is this is a Michigan citizen. They're investing in a Michigan business.
I'm thinking of distressed populations, right? I want to invest in my local community. I don't have thousands of dollars to invest. Yep. You know, I might be at the, you know, poverty level, my family and I. And if I decide I'm going to invest, I'm going to put, you know, $200 a year and invest in that, but I don't fit any, you know, I'm not in the bracket to be taxed. So I'm not going to get that tax credit. Is there a way for me to accrue that?
Yeah. So the tax credit is designed, it was very thoughtful about that kind of investor, because candidly, those are the people we most want to have the expectation that we're going to invest in our own community. And so we're really very interested, unfortunately, in investment crowdfunding and in a lot of the platforms, they recognize that. And it's very common to be able to invest $100 in a project like that. So if you don't need a tax credit, we set the law so that you can carry forward that credit up to 10 years or until you exhaust the credit. So if this year you don't need it, or next year you don't, or the year after, if in year 4 or year 7 or year 9 or year 10 you need it, it's still there for you.
But that's amazing that you can do that. And I like that the legislative piece has that in there, because it is looking at, you know, distressed communities and local communities and stabilization, even of like small businesses. It's all in very intricate.
Yeah.
But how does the state know? I mean, I can report that I, you know, invested in a local business. How is that going to be verified?
Yeah, that's that MEDC part that is going to identify you, and they will issue, you know, the MEDC, I should say, has not been assigned this yet. They know about it. We've worked with them on the bill, and they know roughly what they're going to be responsible for. In fact, they have a request in for funding as part of this bill, so they know they can do the management of the bill. But they will determine that and provide some sort of verification of your investment that you would then use in your at the time of your income tax or with your income tax advisor.
So what if a local business wasn't Michigan owned, or it was maybe 50-50?
Yep.
Are you allowed? You know, what are the details on this bill that you would be able to receive that incentive or that tax
credit? So we're using, because again, it's easiest and cleanest, we're using how the IRS would define that business. And so there's a rule that's called the 80% rule, and basically said that 80% of the assets and sales staff are within the state of Michigan, that would qualify as a Michigan business. So we're using an external verification of the qualifications of being a Michigan business.
So what would this look like for a family-owned business? If you have, you know, a large family and that family wanted to invest in your business, are family members, would they also receive that tax credit, or are they excluded from this?
Not immediate family, but everybody else in the family could invest. Okay.
Thank you for that. And then, you know, I've had discussions with people and, you know, around community capital. And, you know, going back to the discussion that we had on accredited and non-accredited investors, this, you know, quote unquote protection or protecting people from making, you know, bad investments, if you will.
Yeah.
And we could speak to that on the stock market. We could speak to that, you know, for accredited investors in a very large way.
Right.
So how do we know if I'm a local business or there's a local business and it might be set up as a scam, and that they could, you know, is there any type of verification of these businesses? You know, should people be concerned?
Yeah. So in order to raise capital, there are actually a number of checks on that, both on the state level and on the federal level. But like a business that's on one of these platforms, they have to fill out federal forms, which are then verified by them. So this question of fraud is one that we confronted a lot at the very front end of this process. And what I can tell you is that transparency does a really good job of tamping down fraud. So in the almost billion and a half dollars that we've had, there were, I believe, three instances of fraud of the thousands of deals that have happened since then. It's just very difficult to do if everything is open to everyone and it's not done. And actually, I think all three instances were with one particular company and they just made mistakes in that. But so the fact that there's those checks, you get to go on and look on the platform. The platforms are all certified by the federal government and a financial entity called FINRA that reviews all of their documents and approves them or not. And then you can see what the business plan looks like. You can read about the bio of the founders who's involved in the project. And, you know, we encourage people to check it out and be...
You can actually physically walk over there.
You can, and that's the other piece. You know, for us, you know, when I was acting as the City of Adrian's economic developer from 2009 until 2020, I was not intimately familiar with the finances of anybody in the community, with the exception of one or two businesses that I was very close with. And I knew really well what the health of those businesses were by looking at them, watching them operate, watching how they pay their staff and their bills and they take care of their property, et cetera. So there, we have this ability when we can experience it ourselves to have this sort of internal judgment that these are good people. You know, I know them. I've watched their family. Now, that doesn't guarantee that they're not going to fail. But what we find is that those businesses that are funded by community are more successful. So that is some of the data that's coming up. They are more properly funded. So one of the classic problems of business startups were undercapitalization, it's called. So not getting enough money to start at the front end and not being able to survive those first couple of years where it's a real struggle to build the business, pay the bills, et cetera.
So can you speak to what kind of challenges? I know there are several community capital accelerators, you know, that are kind of like in the process. How can communities learn about these, you know, maybe be getting involved in these community capital accelerators, being a part of it, engaging maybe with NC3?
Yeah. Well, we encourage anybody who's interested in this to reach out to us. So, you know, we're a small 501c3, but really active. And actually, here in Michigan, two of the founding board members of the organization were from Michigan. We still have board members from Michigan on the board. And we have a really deep relationship here. And we have had thousands of one-on-one conversations about this because we knew we would have to do that at the front end. We were asking people to do something brand new they'd never done, their parents never did, their grandparents never did. And we still have those conversations. But now, largely, NC3 is really trying to work on a community level. So we still work on individual projects and help with them. But more often than that, we have a community organization that reaches out to us, a nonprofit or a business leader, sometimes the community itself. So the local unit in some cases reaches out to us. But we'll talk to anybody. I'll personally talk to anybody. And so I encourage you to come to our website. So it's nc3now.org. Very simple, National Coalition for Community Capital, nc3now.org. And we would be thrilled to talk to you about your community and what you want to do and help you get it done. You referenced accelerator projects, and this is something that we're piloting right now across the country, not just in Michigan, where we are coming in and helping get funds set up or projects set up and helping with legal structures. We have partners, so we're not a law firm, so we can't offer legal advice, and that's what this is all about, securities laws. But we have partners that work in securities laws and know how to do that kind of thing. So we kind of bring all the technical help to the table and training help to the table, so you don't have to find it. Your community doesn't have to track that down. That was the thing that I learned on my fellowship. I didn't do a great job advancing community capital during my year of fellowship, but I learned why we weren't doing it. And so that became a very valuable lesson for us. And we instituted this this accelerator program as a result of the fellowship here at Michigan State University and what we learned in that process. And so yeah, we're really anxious to help folks and excited about that's what's going to happen. One of the pieces that's particularly exciting right now for Michigan is we've been involved in a process that the EDA, which funds the REI Center, right? So that's the Economic Development Administration. That is the federal government's economic development arm. Relatively small agency
overall,
but nonetheless, small but powerful. Yes. The EDA worked together with an organization called the International Economic Development Council, IEDC. And that's, while it's international, it's largely in the U.S. And in fact, is headed currently by MSU alumni. I just may as well get that in there because I said accidentally the University of Michigan earlier. So very excited about that. But they got some CARES Act money, and the CARES Act money was designed to address those communities, though, and those populations that were particularly badly hurt by COVID and were struggling to recover. And so really, very wisely, the EDA and the IDC recognized that what those challenged communities needed more than anything was capacity, because a lot of times that gets missed. They throw money at it, they don't even know how to apply for the money, let alone administer it and get that done. So
it is the number one need that we hear about at REI is capacity.
It's capacity, exactly. So they created a new corps. It's not AmeriCorps, it's not the Peace Corps, it is the Economic Recovery Corps. And the IDC is managing that. And in this first tranche of capital, they funded 65 fellows who are going to work in communities all across the country for 2.5 years full time on economic and community development projects. And fortunately for us, NC3 applied on behalf of the state of Michigan, because we had to have a specific geography. They wouldn't let us apply for the whole country. So we applied on behalf of the state of Michigan, and we received a fellow. And that fellow will be working here in Michigan for 2.5 years full time to help us advance this community investment, community empowerment work that we're doing. So give us a call, because we've now got some capacity that we can help you with.
Congratulations on that. That's fantastic. I know you've been doing a lot of work. Chris Miller, REI Innovation Fellow and Chair of the National Coalition for Community Capital. Thank you for joining us today. I'm excited to see, you know, future developments around community capital. Listeners, if you have topics around equitable economic development in distressed communities that you would like to hear discussed, be sure to reach out to me at jondyjen@msu.edu and share your ideas. For more information about REI, please visit reicenter.org.